This is Audible.
Cadia Stands by Justin D. Hill. Read by David Seddon. Prologue. Borders of the Segmentum Obscurus. She is four. It is time to learn. Her father lifts her into the night sky. On other planets, the vision above would be a velvet black sky, the cold white light of 10,000 stars, or the strange beauty of a crescent moon. But she is Cadian, and the sky is not dark and star-studded. It glows with the swirling, lurid bruise of the Eye of Terror that stares back down like a cyclops orb. The only twinkle comes not from stars, but from reflected sunlight catching the adamantium plates of low-orbit defense platforms. She starts to tense. Sometimes the eye is purple, sometimes green, sometimes darker patches of unnamed color. Her father's voice brings her back.
"That is the Eye of Terror, the prison of our enemy," he hisses. "We are the padlock that keeps them trapped. That is why they hate us."
"All of us?" she asks.
"All," he says.
There is a long pause as she stares upwards.
"Even Mother?"
"Yes," he tells her. "Even Mother."
There is a pause. She tastes blood in her throat. She wipes her nose and her finger comes away smeared with red. She cannot stop staring into the eye, even though she feels sick. She knows this is a test that she must pass, and she will not give up.
"Does he hate me?"
she asks, sniffing the blood back.
"Yes, the Despoiler hates you."
There is another pause.
"He wants to take our world from us."
His voice is close to her ear. She can feel the breath of his words on her skin and in the tangled curls of her hair. He is passing on what he learned as a child.
"The Despoiler wants our world to burn."
Vomit rises in her throat. She swallows the bile back and stares deep into the darkest pits of the iris, as if looking for a face there. A being to whom she can address her words. At first, she sees nothing. But then, there, in the darkest patches of the purple light, there is a plume of pale clouds.
"What do you see?" her father demands.
But she cannot speak as she gasps for breath. His fingers are tight.
"Speak, child. Have faith. The Emperor protects."
The breath comes with a sudden shock as blood begins to drip from her nostrils.
"A face!"
she says, her voice beginning to break with fear. She squirms for a moment. She wants this to stop, but his hands are firm on her arms, and he holds her up for a little longer.
"That is the Despoiler," he tells her,
and lifts her higher into the air.
"What do you want to say to him, who hates us all and wants to burn our world?"
Blood begins to pour from her nostrils. She will not look away. She will not give up.
"Never,"
she says.
"I cannot hear you."
"Never,"
she says, louder this time.
"Tell him!"
The child shouts into the night sky.
"Never! Never!"
The father brings his daughter down and holds her tight against the chest sections of his flak armor.
"Well done, child,"
he says. And feels relief. It is not easy to expose a child to such things. He watches his daughter walk back to their hab. He is a Cadian and a father. He has done his duty. For her, the true test is yet to come. Part 1. The Summons. Chapter 1. Orbit over Cadia. Below them, The planet was poised, half in light, half in darkness. Major Isaiah Benedict could not tell if a new day was coming on, or if the night was falling. He stood with War Master Rice and his posse of command staff on the viewing platforms of the Fidelitas Vector, and remembered how he'd left Cadia over 20 years before. In those 20 years, he'd had more than his fair share of benighted ice worlds, void moons and jungle worlds with blood-sucking nanobs that dropped onto you from branches above. He'd seen the worst of the galaxy, and now, looking down upon Cadia, he remembered his last moments on his home world. A young white shield, without a kill to his name. Bendix's father had never got the chance to go off-planet. He was one of the 1 in 10 Cadian shock troopers whose draft drew them as a territorial guard. It was his life to stay at home and stand ready to protect Cadia. But war had not come, and that uneventful career was a shame that had discolored his life. When the 16-year-old Isaiah Benedict drew an off-world draft, he was both proud and envious of his son. It was a hard thing for a dour father to express, so he'd done what many fathers had before him. Bought a bottle of Arcady Prime and got both himself and Benedict drunk. Benedict remembered the night clearly. They had been sitting at the round camp table that stood in the middle of the small subhab central room of their home. His father had drawn up the camp chairs and slammed the bottle down between them, set 2 shot glasses on the table. He had forced a smile as he unscrewed the top, crumpled it up in his hand, and threw it back over his shoulder, where it had rattled in the corner of the room. His mother had left them a few plates of boiled grog slab and cabbage on the table. Benedict had tried to line his stomach as his father poured them a shot glass each. "Here," he'd said, and held out the brimming glass. They tapped the rims against each other and tipped the glasses high. Shot by shot they drunk and slowly knocked the bottle back. When the muster bell rang, there was only a little Amasek in the bottom of the bottle. "To your first kill," his father had slurred. His mother, a thin, worn, earnest-looking woman, had joined in with the last toast. It was a short walk to the muster point, where other white shields were being loaded onto rail trucks, their apprehensive faces staring out from under their Cadian pattern helmets. All the tracks led straight to the landing fields outside Casa Tyrok. Benedict and his parents pushed through the crowds to find his truck. Both his mother and father had last words for him, though he was damned if he could remember them. He was only 16 and so drunk he could barely stand. There were no tears. It was poor form to show sadness when a Cadian was sent to fight. It was part of the rhythm of life, birth, training, conscription, death. It was natural that a young white shield would go to kill the enemies of the Imperium. Benedict had imagined himself many times taking the straight route south and never seeing his home again. Before climbing aboard, he checked himself one more time to make sure that in his drunken state he had not forgotten anything. He had boots, webbing, jacket, belt, combat knife, las rifle, 3 battery packs, Imperial primer in his left breast pocket, water canteen in his right. He pulled in a deep breath. He was ready, he told himself, to face anything the galaxy could throw at him. "So," Bendix said. They said goodbye to one another, and his mother briefly embraced him and stuffed a packet of folded brown paper into his jacket pocket. "Crocs jerky," she whispered. She was a tough woman, brought up on a planet where the only trade was war and little given to expressions of emotion. "I want to thank both of you for giving me life. I promise you I will be all that a Cadian should," he said. It was a speech he had prepared, but being drunk, he stumbled on his words and left much of it out. Then he saluted and turned to climb aboard the truck. He looked out to wave goodbye to his parents, but darkness was falling, and they had already turned for home. That was the last Benedict had ever seen or heard of his family. For the next 20 years, other guardsmen had been his brothers and sisters, and the Emperor his father. Benedict found it hard to remember his father's face, but had never forgotten the hug his father had given him, and feeling his father's thick arms wrap around him, his broad, rough hands on his back. His mother's voice had never left him. He could recall her whispering Grox Jerky into his ear, and those words stayed with him and somehow came to mean, look after yourself, and even, you are well loved, my son. As Cadia revolved beneath them, Warmaster Rice put both hands to the carefully tooled brass railings and leaned forward, his breath misting a little on the chill of the foot-thick glass. He wanted to mark this moment with something momentous, yet poetic and memorable. Something that could go in his memoirs when, and if, retirement came. As if sensing its moment, the Warmaster's servitor scribe, an emaciated body with augmetic stylus right arm and waist-mounted scroll, shuffled forward, knocking a few other sycophants out of the way. The scribe had come with the title of Warmaster, and Rice seemed to rather like having his every word taken down for posterity. And now there was no more Deucalion crusade for Rice to lead. It occurred to many of them that perhaps Rice might not be a Warmaster much longer. Perhaps, many were thinking, Rice's star was on the wane, and it was time for them to find one that was rising. Rice coughed to clear his throat, then his bass baritone rang out. We have returned to our mother in her time of direst need. There was more, and Bendik thought the Warmaster's speech could have been better, but the Warmaster finished with a flourish, like an imperial preacher waxing lyrical. Men shall not say that we forgot our duty, nor that we forgot from whence we came. As he spoke, there was the scratch of stylus on vellum, leaving a trail of precise minuscule in neatly justified blocks of text. Bendix could not help reading over the scribe's shoulder, while Rice paused, as if waiting for it to catch up, letting the words ring through his head. Bendict looked away. The Warmaster turned, and as if picking him out for not paying due attention, asked, What do you think, Major Bendict?
She looks peaceful enough to me,
Bendict stammered. Rice smiled indulgently.
Yes, Cadia sent out the call and we have returned. Her need has not been forgotten.
The motors of the Warmaster's bionic arm whined gently, as he patted Bendict on the back. No doubt he had meant this to be a human gesture, but Bendict did not find the crude press of metal fingers comforting.
How long until we disembark?
Rice asked a thin, pale officer with a shock of white hair. The officer snapped his heels together.
Governor Perelska has sent his personal barge to bring you down, Warmaster. Sacramentum is being loaded onto it as we speak. As soon as it is stowed down, I will let you know, sir. The freight captain did not think it would be more than a few hours.
Sacramentum was Rice's Leviathan, a brass-worked marvel of gunnery and armour and engineering that had spearheaded at least two assaults on the high world of Owen.
Good, Rice said. Good.
He was one of those men who liked to fill silences with his own voice. At that moment, one of the adjutants touched the Warmaster's sleeve. The commander of a battalion of Mordians had arrived on the viewing deck. They were standing by the lift in a formal and uninviting group, waiting for an introduction.
Ah,
Rice said, as if a passing chat with the Mordians was all he wanted in the world, and nodded to them all.
Excuse me, gentlemen.
As Rice's entourage fell away, only one other man remained, staring down at Cadia. Bendict took him in through the corner of his eye. He was a first-degree general from his epaulettes, but he wore combat drab, not dress uniform, and had both hands placed firmly on the brass railing, his fists clenching it so tightly that his knuckles had gone white. His boots had not been polished since embarkation. There were mud splatters on the hem of his coat, and dried mud stains on his knees as well. That was a detail worthy of note. Generals didn't often kneel, never mind in mud. Bendict couldn't hold himself back.
Excuse me, sir, he ventured. Are you General Creed?
The man turned to him. He was broad and bull-necked, with close-shaven hair. His eyes were hard and intense. Bendict coloured.
Sorry, I mean, are you the General Creed?
Well,
There are 4 generals named Creed, last I counted. The other man's eyes had a mischievous twinkle. General Osaka Creed.
Yes. I am one of 2 whose name is Osaka Creed. The other, a fine old gentleman of 320 years, has retired to the training world of Kadak. I spent 6 months with him there, working with Katachans. Good bunch. General Osaka Creed had a particularly good stock of Amasek, though I didn't think much of his stubs. They were a little too refined for me. I like something with a little more punch.
Creed's mouth almost smiled.
As he came first, he has the honour of being plain General Osaka Creed. Because I am the second, I am known as Osaka E. Creed.
He put out a hand and Bendict returned the hard grip.
I am honoured to meet you, Bendict said.
Creed seemed amused by the word.
Honoured?
Yes, Bendict said. We were in the same draft.
Were we now?
Yes. I always thought that my career had gone well until I heard you had made general. The first of our draft. To make general by the age of 40 years, Terran standard, was a feat almost unheard of. Once he'd got over his envy, he'd studied Creed and his tactics. And when they'd been in the same war zone, Bendict had followed Creed's career through memos and regimental dispatches.
How do you feel? I mean, you've been predicting this recall for nearly 2 years now, Bendict said.
Creed seemed impressed, but there was no joy for him in being right.
I have. You're right. It would have been better if the recall had started 2 years earlier.
And you were demoted for your troubles,
only pending investigation. Rise, should I say, Warmaster Rise, stuck by me.
Is that because you saved the day on Relian 5?
Creed laughed. His breath smelt faintly of Amasek. Creed was also famous for his prodigious appetite for the bottle.
That's probably half the reason. The other half is that Rice is no fool.
There was a moment's pause as Creed took in Bendict's uniform and regimental badge.
You must be Major Isaiah Bendict of the Cadian 101st, twice awarded the Valorous Unit Citation. You have one of the most highly decorated tank regiments in the whole of Cadia. Between you, your crew has won 6 steel crosses, 4 steel aquila, and the Order of the Eagle's Claw.
Bendict's cheeks coloured, and he didn't know what to say.
Well, yes, sir. My regiment prides itself on its service to the Golden Throne.
The smell of Amasek grew stronger as Creed leaned in and spoke to Bendict in a low, confidential voice.
Did you ever think you would make it back to Cadia alive?
Bendict knew the statistics as well as any other. Half of all able-bodied Cadians left the planet to fight across the Imperium of Man, but fewer than 1 in 1,000 of those ever returned. He barely needed to think.
Never.
You? Creed pursed his lips and his knuckles whitened again. Night was falling on Cadia and the Eye of Terror was starting to glow. There was a long pause. Creed smiled.
Oh, I've always known that I would come back.
Bendict did not know how to answer that. He looked down at their homeworld, grey and blue in the half-light of her sun. And you really think Cadia is in danger?
The utmost danger.
Creed's nostrils flared.
The whole sector has been under attack for years. Plague, treachery, heresy. We see all these proud defences, but Cadia is like a Khazar whose walls have already been undermined.
Bendict was lost for words again. They both looked up to the viewing dome above their heads. In the darkness of space, they could see the turret lights of orbital defences, floating gun rigs, and the bright engine flares of patrolling frigates and stub-nosed defence monitors. You really think so?
I know so.
Creed smiled humorlessly, and his eyes flickered briefly across the room to where a rather embarrassed-looking Rice was trying to explain a joke to the Mordian commander.
Our enemies have planned this for 1,000 years, maybe more, and we have grown complacent. Look, Rice is more interested in little pleasantries with those dreadful Mordians than planning for the war. Cadian High Command is full of men like him. They have no idea how present the threat is. Even the High Lords of Terra suspect little, I guess. The Cadian Gate is in the utmost danger. And it is up to us, honest men like you and me, to ensure that she does not fall. Cadia cannot fall. She will not fall.
There was a long pause. Benedict felt flattered by the word us, but he was shaken by the ominous warnings.
And what can we do?
We shall fight like bastards, Creed said.
And we have to be more devious than our foes.
Benedict smiled.
Is that possible? Life in the Guard has taught me three things, Creed said. Endurance, grit, and the understanding that with faith and courage and good leadership, anything is possible.
I hope you're right. Creed gave him a long look and leaned in once more.
When I was young, my drill sergeant had a favourite saying.
What is that?
Hope, Creed said, is the first step on the road to disappointment.
Chapter 2. Fidelitas Vector, Satellite Embarkation Hangars, Tyrock Fields. No one could remember the last time this had happened. All year, the huge, drafty, impersonal chambers of the processing satellites filled with tithes of Cadian White Shields, who would be loaded onto the cavernous decks of troop transports and delivered straight into the hungry wars of the Imperium of Man. On Cadia, the rhythm of birth, training, conscription, graduation, embarkation and departure was as deeply felt and adhered to as the movement of the seasons from summer to winter, the rising of the sun, the fall of night. Now, that natural sequence of life had gone into reverse. Troop transports were arriving fully laden, not empty. Years of tithes were returning within months, veteran troops numbering in their millions. It was overloading even the efficient Cadian administrators. Long queues of troop transports hung in patient orbit, and even War Master Rice's personal transport, the Fidelitas Vector, had to wait for 5 days before she got her berth.
The loading officer sends his apologies, War Master Rice's adjutant stated, as the War Master took in his brief breakfast of recaf, fried slab, and a pair of freshly poached eggs.
He picked up his silver knife and fork and began to eat. The brooding threat had made him hungry. The War Master ate his way through the 5-day relay. Benedict accepted any invitations he was given to Rice's banquets. He'd spent long enough eating ration-grade food and could not pass up the fine table that the War Master kept. Benedict hoped to run into Urzaka E. Creed once more, but he did not appear. And each time, Benedict made his way back to the troop decks after dinner with an air of disappointment. On the last night, Benedict was sitting at a table, making conversation with a pair of veteran warriors. The first, to his right, called Lynch, claimed to have led the campaign to wipe out the Xenos race called Brynar.
They were not fighters, he said as the servitor refilled his glass with dark red wine.
He took a sip and put the cut crystal glass back down.
They were rather sentimental towards their pupae. It made them particularly easy to trap and kill. The survival instinct was not natural to them.
Benedict nodded politely as his eyes scanned the room for Creed's distinctive shape.
Your name is Benedict,
the man to his left said, reading Benedict's place setting.
Are you one of the Khazar Tyrock Benedicts?
It was a question aristocratic Cadians asked him.
No, Benedict said. I was born in the subhab of Khazar Halik.
The subhab? The man said in surprise.
Yes. And now you're a major?
Benedict did not think he needed to answer that question. His epaulets spoke for themselves. The general, whose place setting said he was named Gruber, took a sip of wine.
How old are you, Major?
40, Terran standard, Benedict said.
The same age as General Creed.
Which General Creed? Gruber gave a little snort of surprise as he cut the smoked fish in half.
Urzaka Creed. I think there are two General Urzaka Creeds,
Benedict took a sip of wine.
Gruber could not tell if he was being mocked. Ursaka E. Creed, he said. Benedict took a sip of wine.
Ah, yes, of course.
What do you think?
Very impressed.
Really? Gruber said, and took another sip of wine. I've always found him a little overrated. Creed did not show up that night or any other. Benedict made his excuses to General Gruber and Lynch and left early. He spent the last full day of waiting for disembarkation in Hab Hangar 0785, playing Black Five with a pair of captains from the Fighting Jackals, Cadian 883rd Rifles. The Fighting Jackals had got fat and complacent with their last posting on a settled world named Andromeda. Bendix didn't like being away from the front line, on principle. Downtime made men soft, and he found from personal experience that it gave men something to hope for, a life that they would never achieve. It was Bendix's duty to relieve them of their coin. In order to distract them, he kept prompting the men to talk of Andromeda, but the more money they lost, the less glowing their stories were.
Well, one of them said, as he watched Bendix shuffling the cards, there'd been a regiment of Karachans there before us. They were still putting the place back together.
After an hour, they were looking unhappy. Another game? He suggested. They shook their heads. Bendix tipped the coin onto the table and began to count it up. Not bad, he thought. This lot should keep him going for a few days in the bars of Khazar Tyrok. A spectacular night, if that was all he had. Benedict slid the coins into his pocket, rose quickly, and put out his hand. Good luck. Next morning, shrill alarms rang out, and one by one, down the long hangar, the three rows of strip looms flickered to life.
Moving out, Sergeant Tyson said.
About time, Benedict said, as he pushed himself up from his bed.
Before him stretched half a mile of figures rising from their bunks, packing the last of their belongings into their backpacks. Tyson took in the empty bottle of Arcady Prime in the bin.
Good night last night, sir.
The memories of his celebration came back to him. Benedict nodded.
Not bad, he said.
He threw the sheets back and reached for his uniform. His flak armour on the bottom, Cadian drab jacket folded neatly on the top. He was still a Cadian, even when drunk.
So, apparently our orders have changed.
Tyson offered the latest order sheet to him, but Benedict wasn't interested.
Does it say where we're going?
Tyson shook his head. Their orders had changed at least 6 times in the journey. They would be manning an orbital defence platform. They would be a mobile reserve. They would be the spear tip of a massive armoured column and sent to the outer planet of Khazar Holn as a first line of defence. Benedict sighed. Sounded like a typical military mess. See if you can find someone who knows.
Yes, sir,
Tyson said. Benedict was up and dressed when his colour sergeant, Dahl, came forward smartly and saluted.
Everything packed and ready?
Benedict asked. Dahl grinned.
In truth, sir, they've been ready since the recall.
It was true. As soon as they'd heard that they were returning to Cadia, the men of the 101st had gone over their uniforms and equipment, polishing, repairing, sewing, fixing, sharpening, cleaning every button, web pouch, blade, seam and item that they owned. It was all he expected. They were a crack unit, elite of the elite. They barely needed leading at times. They were like a sharp knife. All they needed was pointing in the right direction and a little bit of pressure. They did the rest themselves.
Good, Benedict said.
Dahl was so excited he couldn't hold himself back. A few moments later, as they stood over the recaf pot, he said,
Give 2nd Platoon a bit of a dressing down.
Benedict nodded but said nothing. His head was hurting less.
They got a little fresh last night.
Me too,
Benedict said, and took a sip of the lukewarm recaf. This long into a voyage, and the recycled water started to taste of oil and sterilants, and even with recaf this strong, you couldn't mask the flavour. He put the cup down. He couldn't drink any more of the stuff. When's our slot?
0900 hours ship time, Dahl said.
His ship time synced?
No,
We're 6 hours, 53 minutes ahead of planet time. Apologies from the captain. There was not time in the flight from the Mandeville Point. Haste and all that. Bendix nodded and looked at the empty bottle in the bin. Next drink, he thought, would be in the fleshpots of Khazar Tyrok. He could not wait. As debarkation alarms rang, the ballast deck lights of the Fidelitas Vector flickered on, illuminating thousands of tanks and support vehicles parked and waiting. For the journey, their machine spirits had been stilled, but as long files of marching guardsmen moved slowly down towards the troop processor Alpha 4, the armour was loaded straight onto landers and ferried to the planet. The Fidelitas Vector trembled as vast decks filled with noise and fumes. Lehman Russ tanks reversed towards the lander ramps, followed by vast, tracked ammo carriers that creaked under the weight of man-sized baneblade shells, armour-penetrating rounds, and the massive, squat, building-levelling rocket shells for the Banehammer siege cannon. Rice was the first to leave the ship, on board the governor's personal barge with his staff and the Sacramentum.
Like rats, Tyson said, as they watched the governor's barge diminishing towards the planet.
The honour of following the Warmaster went to the Cadian 774th, Titan Killers, with their complement of 3 ancient Shadow Swords. Next were the Cadian 993rd, 57th, the Blue Caps, 1,010 veteran warriors who had spent the last 3 years fighting greenskins at close quarters on the jungle worlds of Semyon Prime. Bendix 101st was scheduled to load onto a dropship late that morning, but their appointed time came and went while they were still waiting on the Fidelitas Vector. They were standing on a vast descent ramp, tilting steadily downwards to the loading decks. Bendix kept checking his chronometer. He'd been in queues like this before, where the Administratum had cocked up titanically and they'd spent days in the exit corridors waiting for their slot to come through.
Looking forward to Cadia? Tyson asked.
Well, I think I missed out on the bars of Khazar Tyrok. But home? To be honest, no, not really. His adjutant looked a little crestfallen. Bendix sighed.
I'll feel better when I touch down, I'm sure. Sure you will, sir.
Bendix nodded. Still a little worse for wear.
I'll get you another recaf, sir.
Yes, please do. And make this one stronger. Bendix was still waiting for his recaf when at last the queue ahead of them began to move, and the guardsmen stood up and started walking. For 2 hours they filed down through long, wide access ramps, still fuzzy with promethium fumes in the troop processing plant. It took 3 hours for their lander, a 3-tiered ferry, to fill with their complement of inducted guardsmen, tanks, ordnance and equipment, and then, with a dull metallic clang, the void chambers were sealed, air supply pipes and magnetic clamps disengaged, and the fat, ungainly landing craft fell towards the planet. The atmosphere inside the lander was cramped and close. There were no windows. Nothing but the hunched shapes of men and equipment, and an air of tense apprehension. For most of their lives, being in a lander meant a new war zone, and there was nothing within the crowded, stuffy interior to distract the mind. Most of his men sat in rows on the floor, their knees pulled up to their chins, heads bowed, helmets on, eyes shut. Bendix's stomach lurched as the lander dropped from the battleship towards Cadia. But then there was the sense of release and of falling. He felt he ought to see how his troops were doing, and pulled himself up with one hand on the metal wall. He made his way along the lines of waiting troops, swapping brief words with his men. He picked out one young lad.
What's your name?
George, sir.
And how long since you left Cadia?
1.5 years, sir.
Bet you didn't think you'd be returning so soon.
No, sir.
Got a girl back home?
George's cheeks turned crimson as he grinned.
Well, yes.
He almost forgot to add, sir.
She drew the Planetary Defence Force.
Bendix nodded.
Good luck, he said.
Bendix was about to pass on when George fumbled inside his coat and pulled out a well-thumbed pict of a young girl in Cadian drab, her hair tied back from her face. Bendix took it. It was what you did when a man showed you his sweetheart.
She looks like a fighter.
George grinned.
She was, sir. Galena fought against the draft decision. Went right up to Cadian High Command.
The sentence trailed off and Bendict finished it for him. But there was nothing they could do. George nodded. Nothing. Bendict returned the picture. I hope she's not forgotten you. But then Creed's words came back to him. Hope paved the road to disappointment. Last time the Cadian 101st had fallen planetwards, they'd been rocked by flak fire from the opposing greenskins. It had been a terrifying descent. But this time, there was no thunder of war, no evasive manoeuvres, no ping of shrapnel ringing on the outer hull. They came in from the north, passing high over the ice-capped peaks of the Resla Mountains and banking gently to the right. Slaved servo guns tracked the dropship as it burned off speed on a long descent over the northern polar regions, following the prescribed flight path that had been punched into the command consoles of its servitor docking crew. The descent took the best part of 2 hours. It was a long, slow parabola, and by the time the landing gear was engaged, and they felt the lander slow to a hover before finally touching down, the men's mood had turned almost jubilant. When the far doors opened, they started to laugh and joke, and there was a great cheer when the vast landing ramp slammed down and the light and air of Cadia swept in. Bendict stood on the top of the landing craft ramp and breathed deeply. Before him was the vast military transit camp that was Tyrock Fields. Cadian High Command had recalled all Cadian units. No one knew when this had ever happened before, and now, as he stood there and looked out across the miles and miles of Tyrock Fields, he was struck by the buzz of millions of Cadian shock troopers. The enormity of it hit him, and he stood, amazed, like a feralled world savage seeing his first orbital craft. The vast flat plain had been turned into a city of tents, parked armour piles of ordnance and rations and supplementary supplies. Bendict could not even begin to guess how many guardsmen were camped here. They stretched away on all sides, as far as he could see. The hum of their activity was a constant roar. There had to be a million, at least. And on the far horizon, like a beast on the veldt, a leviathan blazed its horns in salute as a maniple of warlord titans strode southwards. The titans answered with a trumpet blast and rolled slowly towards him, like a gathering wave. Bendict grinned. He found himself hugging Tyson, slapping him on the back and laughing out loud. They were home. Looking back, Bendict regretted how he spent his first day and a half back on Cadia. He passed up the chance to visit Kaza Tyrock and went with Colour Sergeant Dahl and his support staff to report into the local Munitorum office to sort out their orders. The Munitorum office was a low, sandbagged shack in the corner of Camp 889. They took a ticket, D9973, from a servitor station and waited their turn. The wait was long, but this was Cadia, so it was orderly and disciplined, and the room was full of other shock troopers. They spent the time finding out if they'd ever been in the same war zone. When their ticket was finally called, they were brought to a low camp desk, where a Munitorum clerk rested his hands on the table before him, on which there were ration packs, a sheet of neat papers, and a heavy metal Aquila stamp.
"Cadian 101st, he said by way of greeting.
Bendict nodded and sat, resting his helmet on his lap. The clerk checked his papers.
"Major Bendict? Good. My great uncle was in the 101st.
What was his name?
Oh, you wouldn't know him, the clerk said. He was killed in his first engagement. Crashed Valkyrie.
Bendict had heard 100 stories like that. He was tired and wanted nothing more than to be sitting in a bar, putting his money to good use. War's harsh, he said. The Munitorum clerk was an old man, with wide-set round eyes and a manner of cocking his head that reminded Bendict of an eagle. But he was polite and efficient, and supplied them with their ration books and chits for ammunition, winter boots, medical supplies, and everything else that an army needed. Rations look thin, Bendict said as Dahl looked at the daily food allowance. The Munitorum official turned his head and stared down at him, before cocking it the other way.
Siege footing, he said.
Already, Dahl said. The clerk nodded. Bendict put his helmet back on. He thought he would check their orders.
So we're supposed to be joining up with our tanks and the 74th Armoured Battalion of Northern Command?
The official looked down at the scroll of servitor script he was using.
Hmm,
he said.
Your orders seem to have changed.
Again? The man cocked his head again and looked at him.
Yes, your unit has been posted to Observation Point 9983.
Where's that?
I don't know.
The clerk's cheeks coloured. He clearly did not appreciate surprises like this. Not on his watch. He said, and frowned for a moment as he looked for the missing data. At last, he looked up with an expression of weary resignation.
That is, I fear, classified.
So how do we get there?
I'm afraid I don't know.
And our armour and equipment?
I'm afraid you don't know.
The man cocked his head to the side and nodded.
Exactly.
By the time Bendik got back to their camp, the transports had already set out to Casa Tyrok.
I could drive you,
Tyson offered. How long would it take?
6 hours.
Bendik seriously considered it for a moment, but it didn't make sense.
If they left now, they'd only have time to get there and then turn back round in time for embarkation. Kind of makes the whole idea pointless, don't you think?
I guess, sir.
Bendik cursed. The lights of the camp stretched out in all directions. He looked up at the lurid, purple stain in the sky, and the Eye of Terror glaring down at him. I forgot how bright it is, Bendik said. Tyson nodded.
Freckin' ugly, isn't it?
Yes, Bendik said. He'd missed Cadia, but he had not missed the night sky. The Eye of Terror was brighter than he remembered. Its green and purple light cast a shadow on the ground. It made him sick looking into it. Never, he thought. An instinctive response. Never. A staff centaur arrived at Bendict's HQ tent an hour before dawn.
Are you Major Bendict?
A territorial officer asked as he made the sign of the Aquila in a brisk, perfunctory way.
Yes. Your transporter's waiting.
Good. To Observation Point 9983.
No. Airbase Alpha 443.
Tyson, have our orders been changed again? Tyson blushed.
No. Airbase Alpha is a transit hub.
Where are we going? To Observation Post 9983. The man checked his papers. There was a pause.
I don't see where, I'm afraid.
Bendict's temper was starting to rise. We were told we are being sent to Observation Post 9983. The other officer's cheeks coloured.
I don't know, but I have to make space. There's another lander coming in tomorrow during the parade.
What parade?
Volskani Cataphracts. There's an official welcome.
Bendict was pissed off.
Never heard of them.
Chapter 3. Observation Post 9983. A guardsman had few expectations, yet at the least he wanted to know where he was going to war. But no one had heard of Observation Post 9983, and the 101st had a deflated air about it as the men of the regiment gathered their kit and marched the distance to Airbase Alpha 443. In the skies above Tyrok Fields, flyers were swooping down, constantly emptying and refilling with regiments as some made their way out to the Khazar fortresses along the 10-lane arterial highways, while vast planetary landers brought in fresh regiments.
Any idea where this observation post is?
Colour Sergeant Dahl asked as they saw the lines of Valkyries waiting.
None,
Bendict said. His temper was starting to fray. They hadn't come home to observe. They were the 101st for Thrawn's sake. A figure ran out from the side door of one of the Valkyries. He had a data slate in his hand and looked at it before saying,
Major Bendict?
Yes?
We're ready for you.
Know where we going? The man pulled a face.
Sorry.
What about our tanks? The man tilted his head.
Sorry, above my rank.
Bendict cursed under his breath. Dahl, get the men on board. They climbed up onto the aircraft, platoon by platoon.
That's the lot,
Dahl said, as the last guardsman clambered aboard. Bendict looked about him one last time and nodded.
Right, let's find out where the hell we're heading.
They left their Valkyrie side doors open. Bendict and Sergeant Dahl stood staring out over Cadia. It took 6 hours to cross the checkerboard of Tyrock Fields, and then they were over moors, with armoured regiments crossing the wilds like herds on the savannah. The wind was cold on their faces. It made their eyes water. They had to shout over the roar of the turbines.
"We're heading northeast," Bendict said, for what it mattered. "So much for the drinking district of Khazar Tyrock,"
Dahl said. Bendict stood in the lee of the doorway and looked down. Homecoming was overrated, he thought. Whatever this observation post was, there had better be a damn good bar nearby. A row of 10 Leviathans was making its way across the plains below. Each one was 100 yards tall, a hunched beetle of ceramite and gun barrels, trundling slowly along on massive tracks, with an honour guard of Baneblade tanks looking diminutive next to them. They went in single file, like a herd of giant groks. Their Valkyrie tipped to the side as the men crowded into sea, squinting into the wind. The Valkyrie did a little salute, and the signals officer of one of the Leviathans gave a short toot over the broadcasters to acknowledge them. And then the Valkyries turned south, towards the central massif, and the land beneath them was white with snow. They landed at a bustling base high up in the moors of Cadia's northern massif. It was about as cold and bleak a place as you could imagine, but there was no time to get out. The Valkyries refueled and then set off again, heading south. They flew through the night and got what sleep they could. Next morning, the engines were wheezing in the thin atmosphere.
"Are we lost?" Dahl asked.
Bendict opened the dozer crack. They were halfway up a craggy black mountain with snow-capped peaks, heading towards a vast, vertical cliff face under the summit. Clinging to the side of the cliff, two-thirds of the way up, was a tiny landing pad with a rockrete parapet, a pair of slaved servo bolters tracking their approach, and the tarpaulin cover of a hydra platform, below which was a metal door. There could not be a more bleak and deserted posting on Cadia, and it was there that they were heading.
"I do not believe this," Bendict said.
He glanced at the faces of his men. No one looked happy. The landing pad was only big enough for one Valkyrie at a time. It was a dangerous approach, with mountain gusts buffeting them as they approached the cliff wall. Each Valkyrie hovered as the troops disembarked, and then the empty craft flew away as the next in the queue moved forward. It seemed to take an age for Bendix's craft to get its turn. As they waited, the co-pilot came back to brief them.
"We're low on fuel," he shouted over the wind. "Get your men off quick."
Bendix nodded. He was tense as they made their approach. The black cliff filled his vision as their Valkyrie moved in. The co-pilot waved at them through the cockpit window.
"Ready!"
Dahl shouted, and stood at the doorway as they touched down. The men jumped out with all their kit, still perfectly presented, and ran over the ice-slick surface to the ramp that led down to the parapet. Sergeant Dykeen of 2nd Platoon was there, offering a steadying hand.
"Careful! Don't slip! It's 3,000 yards until you hit the bottom!"
Bendict didn't need a hand. He strode along the narrow parapet and in through the metal blast doors, into a vast, reinforced chamber where the air was warm and dry. He strode forward. After the roar of wind and engines, the inner space seemed almost silent. He paused and listened. In the stillness, there was the distinctive low hum of maintenance engines. He looked about. On the rock-creaked wall in chalk were the crossed flag murals of all the regiments that had been quartered there. The names stretched away into the distant gloom. The last said Cadian 290th Steel Fists.
"What the hell is this place?" Bendict asked.
He turned and looked about at the cavernous chamber and spotted a man in civilian uniform making his way straight towards him. He had neatly combed grey hair, bushy black eyebrows, and bright violet eyes.
"You are Major Bendict?"
the newcomer asked. "Yes." The man's voice was light.
"My name is Rivold. I am the caretaker here. Welcome to Observation Post 9983.
Observation Post 9983 was little more than an icicle-clad parapet and landing pad, clinging two-thirds of the way up a mile-high granite cliff face under a looming overhang of thick white ice. The parapet hugged the contours of the mountain, with loopholes and firing ports staring out into 2,000-yard drops, and an ancient hydro platform draped with tarpaulins just visible under the snow. It was a bleak, cold place, without road or access apart from the landing pad, which was subject to treacherous updrafts, and on which only the most skilled pilots would dare land. Why anyone would want to place a base here was something that troubled them all. Benedict summoned his Vox operator, Mia.
Made contact with Northern Command?
Yes, sir, Mia said. There's an old Vox relay system here. Beast of a thing, he laughed. Could probably talk to the captain of the Vitalitas Vector.
We'll thank him for his hospitality, Benedict snapped. But first, get someone in command. Find out what the hell we're doing here and what the hell we're supposed to be observing.
Yes, sir.
Tyson, has Armitage scouted out this place?
Yes,
Tyson sniffed.
There's 6 floors that we know of, all going down into the mountain.
6, Benedict said. That you know of?
Well, Armitage says that there are doors on the 3rd floor that he can't open.
Benedict cursed. Where's the caretaker? What's his name?
Rivold, Tyson said. He appears to live in a series of officer habs on the 2nd floor.
When Benedict found him, Rivold was praying at a little shrine on the 2nd floor. The doors of the shrine were open against the wall. From the flame of a stubby red candle, light flickered on the image of the Omnissiah, and fresh libations of oil dripped from the shallow sacrarium. Rivold put a hand up to say that Benedict should wait for a moment, and when he finished, he wiped the oil from his hands onto his apron.
The machine spirits here are very old, he said as an apology. They need special care.
Benedict's temper had been rising with each moment he had to wait, and Rivold seemed a safe person to vent it on.
Listen, Benedict said. I don't give a freck about the machines. My men had to cross the galaxy to get back to Cadia in her hour of need.
He felt like War Master Rice, waxing lyrical, and his irritation grew.
We're a tank regiment, and we've been stuck halfway up a mountain in the middle of the Central Massif. Do you know what the hell this place is and why we're here?
Rivold had a look in his eye that seemed to imply this kind of conversation had happened before. He folded the metal doors back on the shrine and said,
No.
Nothing?
I have guesses,
Rivold said.
Come to my chamber.
Rivold led him to a disused wing with brass fittings and polished nalwood doors.
This was once the officers' lodgings, he said. The main barracks are on the 3rd floor. There's room for 3,000 men here at least. I've counted the beds. It keeps me busy between my duties.
Rivold led him through a pair of double doors, marked with the sign of the Aquila, and into a long corridor lit by a single strip loom. The air had a musty, dry feel. The corridors were clean and neat, and in one of the rooms a light was shining.
This way, please, Rivold said. This is my room.
Benedict followed him inside. It was a neat, plain cell. There was a camp bed, a 3-drawer dresser, a poster of a red Aquila, and the bold text, The enemy is listening, keep it to yourself. The furniture was clearly much newer than the rockcrete fittings, which had an ancient Baroque feel to them. Rivold motioned him to sit down on a plain wooden chair. Benedict remained standing.
What is this place?
Observation post,
Benedict cut him off.
Quit the grok shit. Clearly not. Why do they need 3,000 men here? What is it to watch? We're halfway up a mountain.
I can't tell you, I'm afraid. I came here 25 years ago.
And what do you do exactly?
I keep the place running. I pray to the Golden Throne. I keep the machine spirits company. Sometimes units come, like yours.
When?
A year ago. They were the Cadian 9034th Airborne. They were not happy to be here.
I can bet. How long did they stay?
6 months.
Benedict felt sick at the thought.
Is there any way off this base?
Rivold shook his head.
There must be.
No.
Can we scale the mountain or go down? Are there ropes?
Others tried,
Rivold said, and frowned.
I have seen it. There is nothing. Only the landing pad.
One landing pad. 3,000 men. There must be something here. My scouts said there are doors on the third level.
Yes, they bear the name Salvation 9983.
What does that mean? Rivold shook his head.
I don't know.
Can you open them?
No.
Are you sure? The old man nodded. Well, frick all use they are then. There were footsteps in the corridor outside. Bendict put his hand to his last pistol, but it was Tyson. He was breathless. He saluted as Bendict slid the sidearm back into its holster.
Sir, there's been an incident.
He took in a deep breath, and the words spilled out all in one.
The governor of Cadia is dead.
Dead? Tyson nodded.
There's been an occurrence at Tyrock Fields.
A battle? Tyson tried to explain.
It was the Volscani, sir. They turned the guns on the governor at the Landon site.
He took a deep breath and it all came out in a sentence.
Some are saying, well, sir, it seems that the Volscani have turned heretic.
Chapter 4. Observation Post 9983. Without facts, all Acadian 101st had was speculation, and that was not good. Without evidence, a guardsman's mind turned to the worst possible eventualities, as a child in the dark will imagine monsters. Bendict did not care where the enemy were. What they needed were facts. An enemy's location and strength, how best to kill them. Bendict ran through all the units he could think of and tried to get a link through to them. But the channels were overloaded with the bellowing of men in battle. The men and women of the Cadian 101st listened in stunned silence to the vox communications from the fields of Tyrock. Panicked shouts of surrounded units, commanders desperately trying to locate their men, all the confusion and terror of war. It sounded like hell. Bendict punched the wall in his fury.
Powerless,
he hissed, pacing up and down, trying to find an explanation for what was happening as the rumble of war shook Tyrock Fields.
We're fricking powerless!